Hi folks, I'm Alan Watt and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on the 7th of April 2019. As always, I wish all the best to those out there who tune in all the time to listen to the talks, and have been tuning in actually for many years, many of them. And there's always new ones coming in too, new people and younger audiences as well, looking for different things and explanations to really what it's all about, basically. Like the old movie says, what's all about, Alfie? Well, I think everybody goes through the same phases and stages of trying to figure out, underneath the massive deluge of data that's dumped on us, and education too, under the guise of education often, because even history changes all the time as well. You'll notice that we all ask the same questions of what's going on, why does it go on, what really is the system we're living in, which goes through different periods of transformation, although it pretends it's not, and all the different techniques and tricks that are used today to create the illusions of mass demands on behalf of the public to change really the system according to a big plan. They've always said that the rich people rule the world, and of course it's very true. Not just myself, but many before me have talked about that. And we, all the way back in before even Aldous Huxley, that the dominant minority have always existed, and they always will, he presumed at the time during his interview with Mike Wallace. And of course you have a much, much larger academia than ever before across the planet, all working together in different departments and so on, in communication in a global system of internet, etc. So they really do have tremendous power. And they work as the force that brings forth all the changes. And they even raise the children according to what the need actually is, isn't it? It's according to the need of those who rule and manage the system. They raise the children to be the advocates of whatever is needed 10 or 15 years down the road when they'll bring in different things. That's really how it is. It's pretty efficient that way. And over the last few weeks, too, I've talked about articles by people like Jax E. Lull, who talked about efficiency and how efficiency would be used to change and modify the whole, all cultures, all systems, all thought forms, basically, that we are so used to living in. They're already changing, of course, and have changed. So basically efficiency has, and the drive for efficiency, and naturally for those in power, the real powers that run the system, overrides any human element or even catastrophe or that is a fallout from their agendas. And they always have lots of agendas, of course. And other philosophers too have talked about necessity and how, under the guise of necessity, which is often the excuse that they'll settle on to make the public go along with something, they use necessity. We have to do this to save you, either from a war or from yourselves and climate change and yourselves and man-made global warming and so on, anthropogenic warming. So they've got it all figured out, and at least, hopefully, there'll be a few folk down the road in the future who'll at least know and live, and they've lived through some of the changes, the mandated changes, and they'll be able to maybe pass them on to anyone else who wants to know down the road, because that's all you can do. And a long time ago I said that there's so many people turn to self-destructive behaviors because they can't find purpose in a system that's fed them all the wrong reasons. You know it's fake and the reasons are wrong for the way things are and the way they're going to go, etc. And you get frustrated. If you can't get into the old books, if they're still around, that is, to find out what really happens at different times, then you'll never understand that the problem isn't yours. The problem is you suspect and probably know certain things are all wrong. You just don't have all the information to put it together to keep your sanity, because many people just don't swallow the answers they're given. That there are people out there, the more psychopathic, more closer to, and they'll say that everyone's got psychopathic traits. They're like exaggerations of different tendencies we have, in a sense. But the more psychopathic people will naturally gravitate and jump on the bandwagon and start parroting all the nuances and political correct messages that they're given. They understand what they're for. They understand there's a system that now puts this ahead of everything else and does away with even their opposites and things like that. That's how fast things can be changed. But they'll immediately jump on them, just like Orwell said that, you know, who are we fighting today in 1984? Because they kept changing the target, in a sense. But you're supposed to not notice that they always change the target, even though you'll adjust your talk to the new country or the new area that's supposedly at war with. It's the same thing. It's all well understood at a very high level. And those who belonged to the Marxist groups those who belonged to the socialist revolutionary groups in the 1920s and 30s, like George Orwell, they understood that they were well-trained. And where they fell out was when they realized that the communistic system really was destroying, or wanted to destroy, any competition. They didn't really want a parliamentary, you might call it a parliamentary form of socialism. They wanted a more dictatorial form of it. In fact, they didn't believe it would work if you had different dissension groups within a governmental system. And that, again, was further explained by H.G. Wells, because he, again, was a founder of the Fabian Society with Bernard Shaw and others, who were quite open about the fact that they had an open channel, physical channel, all the way to Moscow, to the Kremlin. And Trotsky was in touch with them all the time. Trotsky was always saying to them, you know, your way won't work. You've got to have an instant revolution, whereas the Fabian socialists wanted step-by-step change until you simply morph into the new system. And that's really the perfect technique, because it's so perfected today, you morph into it within a matter of a few years quite easily from one to the next without really knowing that you've actually changed and the system has changed. It really is wonderful to see, in fact, because it's wonderful in that you understand the power and the powers of those who have studied us, and who can then implement the techniques to make us think and work and behave towards a certain goal, or many goals. It is fascinating to watch it. And we truly are. We're living through amazing times when everything that governments once stood for, supposedly stood for at least, have been turned on their heads and upside down. And now they're, with the same authoritarian techniques of putting it across to the public, they're mandating that the public go along with really contrary everything, systems, opinions, directions. It's quite fascinating to stand back as almost like an alien being and watching it. And it helps to an extent to understand what they talked about by alienation. Because in sociology and in socialism too, and in Marxism, they talked about this term of alienation. I mentioned it to someone, or we were talking about the other day, that what they really meant by alienation. In the Marxian version, it was that basically those in the lower orders, when studied in the 1800s, and much before that too, they literally, especially in the cities, they literally felt they were drifting, because you're such a low class of unimportance. That's how it was put across then. You really had no rights at all. You might get casual labour occasionally, if you're lucky. You had no healthcare of any kind, you had no welfare of any kind. You were disposable by employers, literally, physically, because, I mean, people died of incredible conditions in factories during the Industrial Revolution, things like that, crammed into terrible places. So that's how great the nation was when it was at the height of its empire in Britain, for instance. And we forget, we're taught to forget it. We come out with this mushy notion of old BBC plays and things where it's all carriages and wealthy middle class from London or something. That wasn't the country at all. And even in London, there's a complete other side of that too. But what I'm getting at is we're so well studied. Marx said it too, because they all knew it. They remember, the whole idea of Marxism was eventually revolution. And supposedly the workers at that time, they always presumed they'd always be labourers and workers, that they would supposedly, theoretically, ideally, utopically run the nation and the world, which never really emerged, of course. It was certainly used by others for their own advantage elsewhere, of course. But the idea that the symptoms we're describing are dead on, because those who lived in squalor, as you see, because they worked out in different categories, is it squalor that's the problem? No, squalor is a symptom of the poverty. And then the frequent changes of employment, even were often because they were getting fired, or somebody, they were getting a bit older, they get fired immediately because it's easier to hire someone who's cheap and new and younger, you see. That's never going to change either, by the way. And on it goes. So the alienation came because people literally felt, with a conscious mind, you're adrift in the world. And to the extent I understand that, you can feel definitely adrift in the world. And if you do understand, and I understood it when I was young, going through a lot of some of that too, just understanding what was happening when things did not make sense. Big moves were underfoot, or underway, I should say. Big moves to change the whole system. And they brought in, they had to bring in, actually, because of promises to get folk into World War II and to fight again. since a lot of the promises they promised in World War One were not fulfilled, and they gave them a bit more council housing, primarily council housing for working class areas, and then they brought in eventually a healthcare system, which they, of course, they were dismantling about 30 years later. they were dismantling it as well, and still dismantling it and changing it. Whatever is done under any pretext or any legitimate reason, generally is altered again to suit once again efficiency for those at the top. Years and years ago, they had the big discussions about the common market, as they called this little meeting place where they just meet and discuss things, just like the United Nations nonsense, same thing. It was always intended to be much, much bigger, but they fooled the people, they lied to the people, they disclosed the fact a few years ago, they lied to the people from the beginning, because they couldn't handle opposition, and they'd never get their United Europe through if they did. So they lied and lied up to the bitter end. But the public in Britain didn't know it. They were not told. They were not to be told. They actually had that in the memos when they set it up, what its real function was. But I can remember even the farmers who were told to borrow. This European free trade deal would be such a benefit, as they could export even more stuff, etc., etc. And they got loans. The government encouraged it all. They got loans and put their farms down as collateral. And when the EU came in with its big, big, strong hand, it had already decided how much of a quota of milk and cheese and milk and butter and so on that you could sell out and export. And it was actually cut way down. So farmers were already told what they could produce, what they couldn't produce, and so many of them went under. You've heard this before, of course, other things since then, when they did the same thing in other countries, including North America. It's the same con that goes on, borrow, big money, don't worry, I'll get paid back with these deals. And bingo, there you go. You have literally faceless bureaucrats deciding how much you can produce, who you can sell it to, and etc. That's what happens. So there's no real freedom to decide your future in certain areas, in old traditional areas, put it that way, with mass unemployment in the West. And again, back to Margaret Thatcher's day in the era in the late 70s and into the 80s, she said that get used to it, the unemployment, get used to it, to the youth, she says. And some of them will never see work in their lifetime, a whole generation, she said. Well, you understand, they could actually write off all the teenagers who were alive at the time of that speech, and people even younger than her, completely written off from a system that wanted you to vote for them, and a system that wants you to trust them, and so on. It's what an incredible. But mind you, the techniques of controlling the emotion are so well understood, including anger. And she did away with all the pub license and hours, for instance, to keep them open all day, etc. And she said it's better to have the youngsters spending their unemployment or welfare money in the pubs, getting drunk, than have them protesting on the street. Which, of course, and it had to be kind of sober for that one. So they did that kind of thing. And of course, they deluged the media and movies. And lots of sex on these different places. Sex and drugs of some kind or another, you see. Alcohol's a drug, actually. So that was to keep folk from demanding a say in the future of their own future, actually. Now, I really don't think it would have mattered which party was in, personally. I really don't. Because you always find the same agendas go on and on and on. The same thing happened in the US, the same thing happened even when Cameron was Prime Minister of Britain. I mean, folk from outside and inside the country didn't know. His policies were the same as the far-left Labour and Liberal. They all have the same agendas. They all have the same agendas. Because they have to have the same agenda. They're obviously going to fulfil the mandated agendas. Cultural, every way. Financial, you name it. They all do the same thing. And that's the bottom line is that's what Quarrel Quigley said too. Eventually all the parties will say the same things and strive for the same things because they're all being backed by the same rich men in the planet, basically. It's the same with, you think of the old Marxist ideas and communist ideas and socialist ideas when they talked about the means of production. Well, our own governments, if I can't even call them our own governments, really, you know, but the governments all agreed in the West through some strange, we know what it was too, what the groups belonged to and the big movements that back them up and decide things and plan things for them for the think tanks and so on. We know what the agenda was. So they all went for deindustrialization and giving most of the production over to China. And they did it so slickly. I remember living through it, watching it happen. What got me, in Canada, they played it very well, low-key. And folk almost didn't comment on the fact everything was coming. The same things were coming in, same names and logos on things that were purchasing, but they would say in small print, made in China, see? And, of course, India now has got big money flowing into it from the World Bank and et cetera, which we all pay into, to get them really highly developed in industry. And no one complains about other countries coming up, but the fact is, what was given for the West to have replaced their employment? And it's a real puzzle to me, honestly, as to how especially young people are managing, as certain groups into technology might be doing awfully well, but not everyone is cut out for that kind of work. And we don't have all the factories we used to have, where they could lose themselves in manufacturing and creating objects and things and repairing and fixing. It was all gone. And lots of people really enjoyed that and had a good employment from it. So it's there's nothing really was put out there to replace it. So I really would love to have the government studies on real percentages of the youth into adulthood and the statistics to see who's working at what and the different percentages, etc. How many are still living with their parents into the age of 40 and more, in fact, some of them, or parent, in fact, single parent families too, to see how they can survive, because none of them, or very few of them, will be able to actually own their own home down the road, or even today. Because for most folk now, in this global system, the price of real estate has just gone beyond it. It's out to outer space and round the moon and back a few times, I think. It makes no sense to do with reality. But because there are so many people who are now billionaires and trillionaires at the top, then they decide what the policies and prices are going to be on pretty well all the things, especially things like real estate. And some countries are basically almost, they're churning out like machines, these multi-millionaire billionaires and so on, and no one can compete with it, even if you buy their homes. But then that, again, it ties in with the future of a world where you simply won't have private property for the majority of the public. An elite will have, and it'll be accepted. Interestingly enough, too, I was thinking through all of this about those who see certain things often in their own time, and put it across in some way or another that you can actually analyze it and see how much they knew or what they'd picked up on. And I was thinking about, there's an awfully good writer who worked for television in Britain, and he's a journalist as well as a fiction writer, and he's called Dennis Potter. He died about 1994, but he'd lived from the 30s right through to 1994, and he was in on the writing game early, as I say, especially with the BBC and so on, and he bemoaned that the change in the BBC, which literally, the BBC was promoting promiscuity in the 60s. Now, everybody at the BBC at that time had come from Oxford and Eton, you know, that was pretty well, you couldn't get in unless you were from those places. And so they're a government-run agency that worked on behalf of the government. It promoted the Cold War, naturally, for MI5 and 6, to keep us all in a state of well, you know, because we tend to forget. I mean, you wouldn't even know a Cold War was going on, except the declarations that you were so poor because you're paying off debt from World War One and Two, and plus added money where we're borrowing to pay for new defense systems for the Cold War. This is how you're kept under. There was no extra cash in those days, believe me. But they gave you, again, the BBC, it was pop, they call it pop music, and drugs. But it suddenly became available everywhere, you know, LSD, everything, you name it. And these were not getting made LSD by little science guys in the basement. And well, that's another story. However, they gave you the pop music, drugs, and sex, you see. And in about the mid-60s or so, or the late 60s, early 70s, they came out with the pill. And I think it was the 60s anyway, but the National Health Service could. So really, that's a great way to divert your attention from your future. All you're thinking about is what you want at the moment, and it might not be that good for you. But the thing is, youngsters always go for the same things, the same temptations and so on, where it's put right in front of them. But it took them away from the old stage system of simply getting married, a lot of them anyway, and having children and continuing. They want to break the continuity of the old system. That was the whole point of it. So the BBC promoted it. They got the guys on who were interviewed, stoned out their heads on live interviews, and it was like a tee-hee laughing matter, as opposed to, isn't that terrible that you want your children to emulate these characters? I mean, it really was. Some of them were falling off their seats, for goodness sake, and talking gibberish. They were so out of it with heavy drugs. But that's what it was promoted. And at the time, too, they put a lot of movies out by the British. It's not a kind of movie system for making movies. And they were ahead of the US with nudity and so on. So that's what they give you in times of poverty and transition, which in a transition is not going to bring you more money, just more poverty in a sense, and debt, of course. But it's a great distraction. And also aiming towards the children, trying to say you're part of something. There was a revolution they're pushing. Now, here's your government pushing this cultural revolution. Now, during this time period, Dennis Potter, who was an icon of the BBC for a while, for his awfully good productions, different novel way of putting different ideas across. He got knocked a few times when he went into a form of what they claimed was a obnoxious way of putting the sexual content across. He himself apparently was sexually abused when he was about 10 years old by someone he knew, and maybe that had a lot of impact. And it actually did have a lot of impact in his life, and I think in some interviews he actually admitted the horrible effects it has from childhood on for the rest of your life. So he was putting the seedy side of human nature in his movie system too. But he also went through vast changes. His dad was a miner. He saw the vast changes in the system. And he saw the unemployment right through the 60s, 70s, into the 80s. He was acutely aware of what was going on too. But he put some good movies out there, television movies, and one was called Blade on the Feather, about recruitment of the big spy rings from, they were taken from Oxford and Cambridge. Very good, because he had a lot of contacts, obviously, in the right places. And if you listen closely to that one, if you get it, listen to the little quips in it. They're awfully, awfully telling of the system at the time, and the pretense of who's who. Are they really who you think they are? In any position of power, especially politics. And he also did interviews when he was dying. Just before he died, actually, in 1994, he did an interview live and was quite frank about the system, and even called his cancerous tumour, Rupert, after Rupert Murdoch, whom he hated and loathed. He called it for destroying and creating a new trashy journalism style for the media that persists to this day, obviously. But he definitely put a lot of things across about the system in a almost a covert way, about the seedy side of human nature, and also the truthful side of daydreams mixed with the seedy side of life too, which come into it, because he always said that we're made of opposites, basically. That life is opposites. And that angels, remember, too, have opposite tendencies, including Lucifer, for instance, was an angel of light. So you have opposites in life, and there's opposites within humans. But he definitely was rather angry at the destruction of what was called the British press at one time, that was maybe had more ability to say things than later on, and definitely they don't have it now. They don't even attempt to have it now. You have opinion pieces in a light-hearted kind of jocular vein, and that's as far as they go, and that's not really news. But it's safe, isn't it? Now, in the last few weeks of his life, really, he hurried to complete his last two plays, basically, or movies, you might call them, as a karaoke was one, which had a lot of himself in it as a writer, as a character with a cancer, and what happened. And in a very clever way, he put it into the death of the character has to be tied in with cryogenics. And that led to the next and the last one he wrote. And he said he wanted people to understand and to have get more from his work than just enjoyment and pleasure, etc. And he put so much in to the final one, which was called Cold Lazarus, because it was to do with the head of the writer that had been frozen for many, many, many centuries. And then they managed to tap into eventually and stir memories and so on from the scientists. But the future he put into it in the 90s when he wrote that was where we're going. He had a system, a world system, of the top, almost like star quality CEOs and owners of massive international corporations living a life of luxury, which is into the sci-fi realm, you see, literally. They have the group of scientists working on the head, getting a grant to work on the head by a woman who owns probably trillions of pounds worth at that time of businesses across the world and investments. And so everybody who works, and even if they have degrees and scientists and so on, they still have to work for these very powerful callous, because as time goes on, you lose your old civility in this system where money power is rather blatant. And just all the niceties are out the window now. They're incredibly nasty to people if you're employed by them. And it definitely is the real class system that's coming. It's pretty well here, actually, where they create heroes for you to follow that are really just business people, who's often for the businesses are heavily funded with the private public-private partnership deal, because that went through worldwide at the same time from the big institutions, because what they claimed at the time, through necessity or efficiency, we've got to have the taxpayers' money for these massive projects. So, but in the future, in Cold Lazarus, everybody works for these incredible magnates. They also have superstar wealthy people who are superstars because they are wealthy, incredibly wealthy, in what they own, holding companies across the planet, etc. There's no nations, as far as I can tell, anymore. They have quaint names for regions, and that's about it. You find, too, that it's a world where everything's monitored. This is before 2001. Everything's monitored. All calls, cameras everywhere. It's very Orwellian, too, of course. And nothing is missed. Everything's kept. That's transmitted by any kind of electronic means at all, forever. And this is again before much of things happened in the West. And the police dash military group, that they're all clad in black, naturally, and they're armed to the teeth. They're everywhere in the streets and so on, and outside apartment buildings where folk have to rent, etc. And they've got heavy, heavy armor on them themselves too. The cars that you see in it are driverless. They're kind of hovercraft type. They don't go very high, but it's maybe a foot or two off the ground. They're electric in some way or another. Also, they have there's no driver in them. So driverless cars, automatic. You can't own them, although the ultra wealthy elite can own cars. But the people just have to call up, almost like a taxi thing that comes to your door. But everyone's got a number, and everything you do is a purchase by that number. An order for a tax, everything goes down as your, it's like a complete record of where you went, why you went there, etc., etc. So everything is pretty well there. And Potter, I think, knew a lot more than you would imagine, because he got it pretty well spot on. And even people who run a global entertainment business and huge consortiums of TV channels across the planet and so on, are superstars, and just by the fact that they own all. So you got it all pretty well down pat. So it really is. And the cultural changes too. So it's all done there. But we're living through a planned agenda, obviously. Your rights get stripped away under the guise of necessity, because you see there's all these terrible things going on in the world. So everyone has to be monitored, because you can't trust yourself anymore. They've got to keep tabs on everything. You understand, under a tyranny, any kind of tyranny, those at the top, no matter what they call it, they can call it utopia or heaven even, under any kind of tyranny, that they're always going to try and keep you safe. And they do it by using necessity for having to know what everyone is doing or thinking in order to keep you safe. That's the excuse, you see. And you wouldn't want to be unsafe, would you? So we're going to tap in and see what you're thinking. Do you know, this week, in fact, I think Google or some other group out there are actually going forward. And it's funny, I was just talking last week to someone on this thing too. They're going for, to the next step too. They want to literally have to tap into your mind, your brain. Now, that's an old idea, but they're going, once in a while, they float old ideas again as they go through more experimentation. They're always experimenting, naturally, but they want to intersect with your mind, even without a chip in your head, if possible, although that might come and may be more efficient, again, under the guise of efficiency, right? There you go. And with incredible power around a computer, especially even the monitor, you'll find it will knock regular AM stations off the airwaves if you put a radio near it. That's the power it gives off, and it's not really safe. I personally don't like sitting within that field area as far back as possible, because it's not safe. I mean, electromagnetic waves, these are very powerful waves, affect the cells in your body. We know this. It's not disputed. What they dispute is how severe it is, and you know, that's what they dispute. But yeah, I mean, a few years back too, remember in the airports they had little documentaries put out there, articles in newspapers about throwing grants again. See, whatever is used for necessity or even terrorism is great for big business. The articles in the 1990s, that what are the companies going to do that create all the war industry if it's peace? This was as mainstream, general, big newspapers across the world. What are they going to do? It's a massive income and so on. Well, they said that they were going into surveillance and security systems, and that's exactly what they did. Well, now they're getting the Cold War revived, so they can have it both ways. But it's so lucrative that you can't give it up, you see. So you could not have a peaceful world and have all these institutions continue being so strong and powerful as they are. And money is powerful. I mean, the big billionaires, trillionaires, and there's trillionaires in the world, there are. They have a lot of clout, an awful lot of clout in society. And when politicians are backed and given massive funding from different ones, they're naturally obliged to listen to the funders before they listen to the people who supposedly elect them. Naturally, that's the way it is. We've got to break out of the shell of pretense that everything's wonderful and everyone out there is honest about it and so on, right? For those at the top to feel safe, they must have the data on every single person in real time, by the minute, by the hour, by the day. That's how you stay safe. Because I don't think the power never trusts the general population, never does, never has. Never has done. You find from the days of Walsingham and the spy industry from Queen Elizabeth the first time, they had spies all through Britain, paid full-time spies, thousands of them, they're checking it up, and once even going through places like Scotland, taking a form of census on the population, their health, their manpower strength, even the health of their horses and stuff like that. Quite amazing stuff. Defoe was part of that too later on, you know, that's one of the jobs that he did going through Scotland. But so anyway, that's always been the way of spies. And of course, spies too were literally during Queen Elizabeth I's reign and afterwards, they watched for Catholics, you know, And when priests were forbidden, Catholic priests, they hung them if they found them in the streets. And spies everywhere. I mean, you'd understand that, as I say, history is a horror show, really. It really is. I really don't expect it to be. I mean, you can get. Today we're so calmed down with a more perfect way of government governing us that they can do it so well without overt force all of the time. All of the time. And it's almost like stroking your mind this is okay. Look at the happy little bitsy stories you get everywhere you open them up, and all the cat and dog stories and stuff like that. Wonderful little things, but you aren't going to get told anything that really matters. News has changed, really changed. In the last 20 years especially, I'd say, but before that too, according to Potter, but in the last 20 years, it's definitely changed big time. And people want their paychecks. Potter mentioned that too in a big talk he gave at McTaggart, the McTaggart Centre. to other journalists about the fact that they're all pretty well on they're the propagandists, the journalists are the propagandists for the rich and wealthy. But for those, as I say, that want to understand at least a bit of what happened in the past and how the best of intentions can get used as well to get the people to go along, there are always those who see incredible profits in times of crisis. I always think of the Council on Foreign Relations. I can't remember which one it was. Was it Hart? Was it Gary Hart at the time who came out in the newspapers, and I think at the time of 9/11, 2001, and he said, how can we use, that's a favourite thing they say, this crisis to our advantage. And he's talking about to their global agenda, for instance. And that's what they mean by to our advantage. He wasn't talking to the general public. To our advantage. And you've heard it since then by top business people and so on. How can you use this crisis to our advantage? And why let a good crisis go to waste and so on? It's even in the movies now, that kind of thing. Because that's the way it really is, isn't it? That's how it really is. And so the whole idea that they've settled on, united with the mantra of global warming, then turning into climate change, and as the Club of Rome said, famine, plague, and deserticate, that kind of stuff, a drought, meaning overpopulation, that's what they really mean by it. That would fit the bill. So man was the enemy. So a war on humanity itself, there's too many of us, we're all consuming, we are the enemy of the planet, we're the enemy of those who control it all, so we've got to stop and be ruled by those who are, will rule us from birth to death. And down the road it will happen, you will go into the state where they'll decide, they're already talking about it again, but they always float the same ideas from top sources and universities and professors who all belong to the big global CFR type system. And they say, well, you know, we should really have people licensed to have children. And then they'll say, well, and lots of folk will agree with them because there's an awful lot of terrible parents out there and horrible parents and so on. But you can't take the complete rights from the people under the guise of the minority do it. You can't do that. And it's too easy to demand wrong things or demand what controllers want you to demand to your detriment, really. And if you look at what the controllers are doing to even children and what they're indoctrinating them with at the moment, by law, you can't keep falling for the same reasons that they give you. But they also have said that eventually, I remember reading about in the future, because way back in the late 60s they had articles in the newspaper about the coming utopia. I'm not kidding you, that they had the big global meeting, the Council on Foreign Relations, Royal Institute for International Affairs held in Britain, when they even decided what countries would be basically tourist countries, like Scotland, they were turning a tourist, it'd be totally deindustrialized. Well, they did that, that's true enough. And other countries too. Nothing was put to the vote from the public. These are private institutions that run the world. They're the establishment on behalf of the ones who own it all. But anyway, they also said that, yeah, and they had drawings of people in togas, Roman togas, where they'd have conquered the climate and they could create climate. And you'd all walk about in these Roman togas and sandals on your feet. All your needs would be given to you and managed because everything would be so automated, etc. And those that they needed, humans they needed to give employment will rotate a certain class at the top who would volunteer to work, and it would be a privilege to be accepted to volunteer to work for this system, this global system, as we walked about in Roman togas, which it must mean in Canada and some other countries they've eliminated mosquitoes, I'd suppose. But anyway, this is what they floated around, and they were telling how wonderful it was going to be. And then when they totally deindustrialized and they cemented the European Union and did their quota system on production of even dairy products and food and decided who was going to import what from whom, and they cut out all the mutton and so on from New Zealand and Australia, things like that, and then they dumped stacks of butter and dairy from France onto Britain, put other folk under. This was their utopia. You understand, they give you such incredible lies. Remember, the communist revolution was going to bring in utopia. That was the idea. And if under the guise of bringing it all in, you would have a system of giant, giant supermarkets like we have today, where you get everything, build all center types, you get all your what you need for hardware, everything. But people would go in with cashless society, you'd eventually need cash. You might get credits, you see, and tokens given to you, like Russell said. But you'd only pick up what you, they would have no staff there, you'd pick up what you wanted automatically, be a guest checkout or whatever, But the people would be so well trained and decent that it would only take what they needed, not any extra. That was an incredible utopia. Well, in that case, you've got to talk about changing the choices of humans, because even the bad choices come from a human trait, and many traits are actually, even survival. People often will shoplift because they're terrified of whatever. There's a good documentary up there of a woman who was one of many women that were sent off to the terrible Soviet gulags in Siberia. Awful stories, incredible stories of them. And when they come out, they're alive, some of them, or they're alive then anyway, back in the 90s, maybe, or 80s. And one of them, literally, she showed you her house, big trays, baker's trays of loaves of bread. She said, I can't eat them. She said, but I can't stop myself from ordering them. The fear of the starvation she went through is horrifying to her. That'll never change. There are many traits that are just natural traits that become exacerbated and amplified by terrible Pavlovian situations. And the reflexes that she's got now, she just can't stop, you see. What a horrible, horrible outcome. That was a utopia, you see. If you disagreed with the utopia, you were put in a mental hospital because you had to be mentally ill to criticize the Soviet system. That was what they diagnosed you with. Since it was a perfect system, right? So you obviously were psychotic. And I see, unfortunately, the same techniques being rolled out under 1,000 different guises throughout society with the what's now called politically correct mandates. And as Orwell had thought crime and all that kind of stuff. Tyranny really is fairly continuous. There's different strengths of it for different periods, but it's the same techniques that are always used to silence people, because tyranny does not like something that's so important, and that is the ability to speak. Whether you like it or not, you have to have the, it doesn't matter if a person's stone crazy, the fact is they've got the right to speak. Because after all, someone's deciding he's stone crazy, right? But he's still got the right to speak. Or she, depends, you know. But the thing is, tyranny always silences it. Under guises, they're mentally ill. Or whatever it happens to be. And don't believe it, the same tyrannies that back in the 80s and 70s started dismantling all the psychiatric hospitals across the Western world. At the same time, by the way, and in the States as well. And put them out on the street. They really care, eh? You better start thinking here. The old saying, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it is probably a duck. So when you see the same symptoms arise in society, it doesn't bode well. When you see well-trained, massive mobs, well-organized mobs, being allowed loose on streets by our governments, this isn't just a happenstance flash mob spontaneous. This is obviously authorized to get something else through. Even the clashes they're creating everywhere in the world, and I really think there'll be a lot more to come. I really do, because I can't believe in this age that governments are going to stand back and just let it happen. They're getting something out of it. There's a mandate down the road. And I mean all kinds of them too. I mean, there's even ones now that are attacking farms in different countries. And now they've got they want international groups to do it all on the same day, etc. As an example, what you're seeing is, it's getting back to the Soviet system, when there's no tolerance, you've got an intolerant society. And when it's mandated, things are mandated by law, then your governments are obviously intolerant. How can you be democratic? How can they be? They can't be. They're one or the other. Which one? Which is it? And the whole idea of democracy is something balances the other. That's why the idea of extremes in government parties, well, they don't. They're all the same, pretty well, aren't they? And it's a dangerous situation. Eventually, they hope to wither away the governments, as the state would wither away, according to Marx, you know. And we'd all accept this form of being governed. Or really ruled. And even though we're ruled at the moment by forces unseen and massive think tanks across the world that work privately and dictate to governments, it seems, because governments certainly use them all the time, we don't vote them in, then we're run by a very mysterious system at the moment, aren't we? So as I say, I hope down the road that even the newcomers will stop blaming themselves for everything that they think is wrong in their life. I do understand what they mean by alienation. You know, for a lot of folk who feel it, they become despondent, they feel they don't fit in, that there's no purpose down the road for them. And believe you me, there's reasons why you're like that. And very possibly just informing yourself of the past and getting in to the societies that we really live under in, and the systems that control everything. It's all out there, actually, if you want to dig for it. There's no conspiracy stuff involved, because the big think tanks publish so much of the stuff themselves, and universities that work with them publish a lot of articles and about how control is used for they call it peace, etc. And it's awfully interesting too that even, I always remember the old saying that the Soviets said that their struggle would be over when there's peace. Because they kept pushing peace. Like, it's awfully hard for the West to say, to young folk in the West to say, well, they want peace, for goodness sake, you know. But no one thought to, see, definitions are so important. And what they said was peace, when they're really, really pushed, peace is the absence of all opposition. That's what they meant. Khrushchev said something similar too in his talk, I think, over in the US in the 1960s. And he said that you're all worried about something you shouldn't be worried about. He says, your children will all grow up in a socialist, he's talking about a Soviet type socialist system. And it'll all be quite natural to them, but they'll do it without struggle. They'll do it without any terrible, terrible consequences. He says, they'll grow up in it naturally, never knowing that it was literally designed for them to do so. That ties in the Rees Commission, and that's another story again. However, I've prattled on long enough tonight, and I didn't even mean to go this far on. I meant to just touch on Dennis Potter's karaoke. It's entertaining, and it has a system inside of it, and it has his own story inside the story. As he's got cancer, he's actually, in a sense, like the character in it. And then Nicole Lazarus with a future that, even for the budgets of the day, they did pretty well, I would say. And showing you a future that still is more apparent now than it was even then. So before I just sign off here, I'll put up some articles that'll tie in with what's current, because it's hard to find current stuff now. It's all, there's very little real news anymore. It truly isn't, you know. Things are important, we're not really told about. That way, agendas can go forward from government, and we're simply oblivious of them. But there's one here, I've mentioned it before, but the freedom of the press. Awfully good. Well, Orwell explains, once again, as I'm putting it up, but he explains why you must have different opinions about everything. You must have it. If you give in under one topic, you give in, give up with all the rest of them too, and you won't like it down the road. Also, you've got new tax, bad news for those on the land, and so on. We're getting all the carbon taxes coming down. Also, Mark Zuckerberg, they've used him, of course, asked governments to help control internet content. Isn't that interesting? Eh? So, I mean, yeah, the guy who said you're all stupid effers, he said, you know, is now saying that government has to come in too and help controlling it. And there you go. So, it's, and I understand a lot of stuff. Folk can't even be decent on the internet. But then again, you don't know what the bots are. And there's government agencies got stacks of bots that can turn loose on anybody that don't put out the real hate stuff and hate speech and all that. Of course they do. There's nothing, you don't know where any of this stuff's coming from that you read. And then the US military to develop genetically modified plants, like green plants, right? Vegetable type plants, to spy in environments unsuitable for traditional sensors. New synthetic biology programs make use of natural capabilities to gather intelligence. One day, like Prince Charles, who talked about talking to his plants, you know, they'll start talking back to you. Also, two, again, how they keep changing names when the public start to catch on and use it in their conversations, like NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, and all the terrible things to do with it. And so they changed it to USMCA, which is more of a mouthful, but it's really just NAFTA rebooted. But also, the Trans-Pacific Partnership deals, too, that we was complaining about at the time, too, are all incorporated into this new USMCA. I'll put the article up if anyone really cares to know about it and so on, and check it up for themselves. You got to find it for yourselves. I haven't gone through all to see, but it wouldn't surprise me at all. Because they already did the free trade things for the Pacific Rim negotiations separately as well. They'd already signed these things in. And the public, we're completely oblivious or ignorant of what they are, aren't we? And do you have time to read thousands of pages of things? Of course you don't. Neither do the politicians, they don't read them either. They don't. I mean, that's not being facetious, is true. And then another one too. This one here on France, cited as a source of largest number of wealthy migrants coming in, or coming and going actually. And Canada, this is Canada, attracted just under 10% of the estimated 82,000 millionaire migrants who changed country last year, according to a recent report. Because as a breakdown into the wealthiest, well, the countries where they're moving to, for mainly for safety and so on, you know. And it says New World Wealth said the inflows into Canada were boosted by large-scale migration from China into Vancouver and from Europe into Toronto and Montreal. Canada's the second most popular destination for wealthy Chinese immigrants. It's a South Africa-based market research group, New World Wealth, it's called, said the overall number of millionaires on the move last year around the world rose 82,000 from 64,000 in 2015. Now, what they claim here is improved education, higher personal safety were the main drivers when those wealthy people sought out new destinations. So it makes sense, too. They want to get to, and to the U.S., too, that the big Ivy League universities they want to get into, that sticks with them for life. They'll meet the people they'll work with down through life as CEOs and corporations and government, like Maggie Thatcher said to herself with Britain when she started using the taxpayers' money to fund the private schools and universities and so on. Our university system. The class system's alive and well, and believe you me, the class doesn't care where you come from as long as you've got the money and you can learn, you delve into this new, I think Jacques Attali called them the new nomads. They go across the world, and where the money is where they go, and they'll move again if they need to, and that's how it's to be for the future, nomadic life existence. Australia has the fastest growing number of millionaires on the planet, it says, and you'll never believe the countries we beat. Now, it's interesting, this all comes out at the same time. It makes you put a different spin on different things, but they might come in with lots of money, but will they benefit you? I very much kind of doubt it. Most of these big wealthy people have international investments and the same stock markets and stuff like that. You know? So it's just the way it is. Also, I'll put these articles up regardless anyway, but you see now. Oh yeah, the carbon, a whole bunch on carbon taxes. And again, the private organizations, the think tanks, even some of them labeled as charities, are driving and pushing it all. A lot of Washington, D.C.-based conservative think tanks that are charities, that are labeled as charities, are promoting the carbon trading schemes and so on. And years ago, I gave talks, because I listed all the companies, the international companies, were all for bringing in carbon taxes. And you would think, well, my goodness, it's going to cut back on. No, they're not. They're going to make a fortune off of it because they trade the carbon. It's like a stock market. They were all for it because, how can let this crisis go to waste, you see? So you create an appearance of a crisis, then you get the public to fund the beginnings of the carbon credits to trade with. We did. I read the articles at the time. And then they get them for nothing and then start trading with them and they can get billions off of it. Well, what a... We just don't, we're not, you either have that gift of following that kind of technique, or you don't. When it comes to money, I just don't understand it. Honestly, I have no interest in this or that, or investments, or how things are done. To me, it goes over my head, and I kind of shut down on for since school, I've done that pretty well when it comes to numbers. But the ones who have the abilities to catch this stuff, and they can make fortunes, and they do, naturally, you know. And the AEI holds Carbon Tax Lovin', it's called. This is one of the American Enterprise Institute. It's amazing that's labeled a kind of charity and all that. And a think tank. And they're really pushing it for, because it's big money for corporations, obviously. A carbon tax AEI, really, it says, is another one. And then the philanthropists who think a carbon tax offers the best way forward on climate policy, you know. And they can certainly pay all these big characters to put things in the media is quite happy to put anything in if they're getting paid to do it, because especially these days, you know, newspapers. And then Mike Cannon Brooks, Atlassian billionaire, calls on government to reinstate carbon price, naturally, you know. And so we're all going to pay through the nose for something that was dreamed up a long time ago. And at the same time as it dreamed up the whole idea of blaming us for being the problem, too many of you, and you're going to get awfully even more rich from it, from their carbon exchange. You remember that Al Gore was involved with literally blood and gore carbon exchange to begin with, eh? So he had a lot to win from pushing it all. And anyway, I'll put these articles up for those who care about it or are vaguely interested. We're all going to pay regards. Nothing's going to change it. And then getting back to it, lock your gates, install CCTV and vet new staff carefully. Advice to farmers ahead of major animal activist event by militant vegan groups. Now, where do you think they all came from, and why do you think government's allowing it all to happen? Hmm? Huh? Come on. There's also floated that an article in the British papers that Julian Assange was about to be expelled from London embassy and arrested following a deal with Britain. But Ecuador's UK ambassador rejects the claim that he's going to get expelled from their building. So we have to wait and see what's going on there. I don't know if it's just to keep his name in the paper, because it's true enough, when the limelight's off is when the wolves, and the wolves have plenty of time, and they can wait, just like they'll say, tribute to the devil, the time is on their side. They wait and wait, and then they pick you off when they think no one's looking. And it's true, like every regime's done that, and they will always do that, I suppose. And also, a floating city dubbed Oceanix, this is where the recession development money goes from the taxpayer, will save coastal cities from flooding caused by climate change, the UN project claims. So the UN Department for Sustainable Development teamed up with the Oceanix and MIT, an explorers club, in a partnership to build a prototype that will be open to visits by members of the public within months. And that will be the multi-billionaires that we're reading about here, because they'll end up getting investments in it and public. They'll get back dollar to dollar, by at least dollar for dollar, by the governments using in tax money and so on. Interesting, eh? How things go. But believe you me, you're never going to have a static system. That's what people, I think, often wish that they had, a static system. They even had articles out many, many, many years ago about stop it, you're changing too quickly. You don't have time to catch your breath. Things just disappear. Even buildings that your parents could refer to are no longer standing. They just knock them down in no time. So you can't even relate to people that are just a few years older than you. Everybody's, again, this idea of alienation. It's all part of a technique too. Sad. But we're given no choice in the things, and no say in anything either. As I say, at least you have the supposed system of a democracy where opposing viewpoints are supposed to be discussed. Believe you me, if you don't have that, the elite themselves will bring you into the cold Lazarus system in no time at all, with no opposition. And then you can never go back to having a say in anything, or even a pretended say in anything, or even some other people that you'll vote in to speak for you. It won't happen. The public are a nuisance, an awful nuisance, to those who want to rule and promote and guide the world. That's why it's far easier to go this way, wean you off of even involvement in what they're up to, and getting you used to being simply governed. Until you stop asking questions, or even asking who's governing you, you see. Then they can get things redone quickly, and that's the agenda, folks. That's what it's about. Anyway, sorry for prattling on. As I say, I know I was going to spend 10 minutes on just what I've said here, but I think it's important, because I think time's running out, and I feel it in the air. I feel there's big changes happening. There's definitely something. It's almost like a switch been pulled or switched on or off or whatever. But as you go into this new system of more intolerance, and it's rather sad that I don't think it bodes well at all. But that's the way it is, folks. So I hope you get something out of it. I hope a lot of the younger people get something out of it too, and realize that life is not just fun games and the occult. The occult just simply means hidden, remember. We truly are, in a sense, in an occultic system. Most of what the public thinks that they should know is they don't know at all. They're not given. Secrecy rules, and governments, of course, say that they must run things in secrecy, or they get nothing done at all. There's a partial truth there too. It does have so many objections, nothing would get done or fixed, or roads or whatever, that kind of thing. But it goes too far when folk get off of what the rules are, you know, or they throw the rule book out the window, which is a terrifying thing to contemplate. So for myself, from a still really end of winter, there's a thaw going on, but a lot of snow to move, yeah, get down to before the grass shows here. For myself, Alan Watt, Ontario, Canada, it's good night, and may your God or gods go with you.